And I work at, I'm an epidemiologist from Roswell Park Cancer Institute in Buffalo, New York. I actually do tobacco policy research and bring that perspective to this topic. This is actually my first talk on a non-tobacco policy-related thing. But from what we've learned from tobacco are things that drive sort of population-level interventions, pricing policies. Few will argue that they are perhaps the most effective tool in reducing tobacco consumption. Things that have broad reach are going to be most effective. So I'll tell you a little bit of story of some of the work that we've done here, more population-based. Along the way, I have no financial disclosures. And by the way, feel free, if people can grab the talk or email me. I'm happy to engage in a dialogue or anything. And this is a complex issue, and this is just one sort of sliver of this issue that I'll be sharing with you here. We heard a little from the previous talk nicely laid out the evidence looking at sweetened beverage consumption, calories to obesity, liquid form. These are covered in the previous talk. Being obese isn't a healthy state to be in, so that sets the sort of public health stage for these things. Some public health initiatives, there's more than one way, like in the concluding remarks in the last talk, there is more than one way to address this issue. The focus here, some have advocated for price increases to try to incentivize, to disincentivize what we would perceive as poor nutritional choices and incentivize better nutritional choices along the lines of sort of making the healthy choice the default choice along the way, which I think is an overarching framework, is an excellent message that we should be carrying out into community. So in New York City, for example, information alone helps, but portraying it in ways that are reach the target audience, such as this one, are you pouring on the pound? So again, lessons from tobacco. It's not just like, don't smoke, but really organize social counter-marketing campaigns to try to address the public health problem. Some experts have said, maybe if we increase the price of sugar-sweetened beverages, we might be able to curb the rising rates of obesity, which are associated with adverse health outcomes. And there's a long literature in tobacco in particular showing the almost universal effect across just about every study. The higher prices are, you see decreases in consumption, and really to take that framework and put it into this this topic here. There are some taxes, sort of general taxes, already on sugar-sweetened beverage taxes. About two-thirds of states charge their sales tax and apply it to soda and other sugar-sweetened beverages. Other states do not, creating this differential. But those sales taxes are relatively modest. So if the tax is small, then that impact is going to be small. But the evidence from the literature looking at when prices rise for sugar-sweetened beverages, what's the corresponding decrease in consumption? It's about a one-to-one relative contribution. So for about every 10% price increase in sugar-sweetened beverage, you're looking at about a 10% reduction in consumption. 8 to 10% is a range that's been found. And just as an aside, if you look at tobacco, the consensus estimates are for every 10% price increase in tobacco, you're looking at about a 3 or 4% reduction in tobacco consumption. So from that perspective, you're looking at an intervention that's probably about twice as effective as the price increases on cigarettes. Now, I got motivated into this. So I'm in New York, and we're broke like everybody else, and our governor said, hey, we're going to generate some revenue, and it proposed a tax on sugar-sweetened beverages, and that in two legislative sessions was seriously debated but did not pass. I run a survey center as well, so I'm like, oh, okay, we've got an opportunity to get some grant money in. We'll field a survey, we'll try to study this issue, and we'll baseline data, and then when a policy is passed, because somewhere out there somebody's going to pass a policy sometime soon, and then to do some follow-up work. So along with that, we did a sample in New York, but then we also did a national sample. So while it says a pilot study in New York, it's really a national sample with an oversample in New York that we've done. As mentioned, really, sugar-sweetened beverages are a no nutritional value food, really just contributing calories. And in our study, we wanted just to get some basic details of like who actually drinks sugar sweetened beverages and what do people drink and what are the characteristics of those people? And what if there was, say, a penny an ounce tax that was increased? What impact would that have on revenue and on excess calorie consumption? So these were some of the motivating factors. So really top, really 35,000 foot view of things, just to try to describe the patterns of use, because in my look at the literature, it wasn't clear. There are individual studies and individual populations, but not something across the board. So as I mentioned, we did a national sort of random digitile adults 18 plus. We did about half our sample nationally, about half of our sample in New York City, and then I've also got a site. We layered on a cell phone component of this as well to try to increase our coverage of younger population in particular. These data were collected over the course of about a year from spring 09 to spring 10. And we asked questions about, really, we tried to get a 7-day recall of their beverage consumption patterns and went through a list of really what people drink and to try to assess that. And we also got information about attitudes and beliefs, and you'll see that as I go through the results. I mentioned a cell phone component as well. Some of these, we're still working on some of the weighting issues related to that, but we've looked at the data, weighted and unweighted, stratified, landline, national. The results, there's some differences, but generally things are relatively consistent, and I don't want those methodological nuances to take preference over the core of what I want to share. But some of the real core questions that we did ask is, in the past week, approximately how many servings of fill in the blank sugar sweetened beverage have you consumed over the entire week? And things that we asked about were things like Kool-Aid, Gatorade, lemonade, high C, sweetened iced tea, regular soda. So individual questions asking, have you consumed? And then if yes, how many servings have you consumed in the past week? And then we asked questions about how about vegetable and fruit juices and some examples of products that were given down here. In particular, we asked about coffee and tea and whether people were sweetened or unsweetened. And if from a sugar-sweetened beverage tax perspective, somebody putting a packet of sugar in their coffee is much more difficult to regulate from a taxation perspective. So we kind of present the results, including that as a sugar-sweetened beverage, but also excluding it and looking at pre-packaged sugar-sweetened beverages as well. So some of the results that we've got here. On the right half of the panel are the percent who reported, yes, they've consumed at least one of these types of beverages in the past week. So two-thirds report drinking a sugar-sweetened beverage in the past week, a pre-packaged sugar-sweetened beverage. So this is basically your regular Coke, Pepsi, Mountain Dew type products, as well as Gatorade, other sort of prepackaged sugars, and I'll break this out in the next slide. If you include the sweetened coffee and tea, it increases a little bit. So that's the percent who just report. So the majority of adults in the U.S. drink at least one sugar-sweetened beverage, only two-thirds, actually. And when you look at the average number of servings averaged across the whole population, the number I want you to focus on is at 6.46. So this is averaged across all adults throughout the U.S. We estimate that they consume about 6.5 pre-packaged sugar-sweetened beverages every week, almost one can of soda every day. And then when we look at this, how this is broken out by different categories of beverages, we've got sugar-sweetened beverages, regular soda. So half of adults report drinking at least one regular soda each week. And then to get the percentages in the other slide, you have to combine some of the categories, and there's overlap across them, so they don't match up exactly. But that's, so you've got half drinking regular soda. You've got a third drinking diet soda. You know, 20% are still drinking whole milk. Just sort of enumerating out what are people actually drinking. Now, what are the focusing just on the prepackaged sugar-sweetened beverages? So these are your Coke, Gatorade, sugary beverages. Who's actually consuming these? And the predisposition are for males, younger, lower income, education, and racial ethnic minority, in particular African American. So you've got poor less educated racial ethnic minorities are more likely to be consuming prepackaged sugar sweetened beverages along the lines here. In terms of knowledge, attitudes, and beliefs, we asked people, you know, is frequent consumption of soft drinks, does it increase your risk of obesity? Most people agreed with that. Diabetes, other factors. So there was high knowledge about many items, but things like asthma and cancer in particular, me being from a cancer institute whose organization just accepted exclusive pouring rights from Coke so that they could have that in their cafeteria, made me wonder, like, maybe there is some education to be done. At least in our national sample here, 40% of adults, only 40% agreed that obesity is related to cancer. When we stratified this, looking at among those who reported drinking a sugar-sweetened beverage and those that did not, we actually didn't see any statistical differences, although there was slight trends in those who were drinking the sugary beverages to have slightly less knowledge, but we didn't really see anything jumping out, nothing statistically significant here. When we asked people the question, how much would a 20% tax on soda and sugar-sweetened beverages affect your consumption? So the hypothetical, because the intervention hasn't happened, 40% said wouldn't impact me at all, 40% said they would cut back on their sugar-sweetened beverage consumption, and 20% said that they might switch from regular Coke to diet or to other drinks. And there is some literature looking at the substitution of beverages along the way. And this is interesting too, because if there is substitution, I don't think that there's consensus that if people are switching from regular Coke to diet Coke, that that's good for public health in general. I think there's consensus it should reduce caloric intake, but will improve health outcomes population wide. I think that's still open for debate. In terms of support for support for a tax on regular soda and sugar sweetened beverages, about 40% of adults report support for a policy like this. And when you look at the characteristics of who supports it, you're looking at females, younger, and more educated. Not surprising. So at least that gives you something in terms of you're going to work to try to educate people and look for to try to boost that 40% up to something that's higher. And smoke-free debates, once you get about 60% of the population saying, yeah, bars and restaurants should be smoke-free, it becomes an easier road to go. Now, when we look at projected soda tax revenue, because policymakers are looking at bottom line on this, again, this in New York, this was motivated really by financial concerns, spurred along by folks in chronic disease programs saying, yeah, that we might really be able to get some health benefits along the way. But if you assume 6.5 prepackaged sugar-sweetened beverages per week, 227 million adults, so that's about 1.5 billion sugar-sweetened beverages per year, per week, 76 billion per year. So that 1 cent per ounce would generate $9 billion a year. That might make a nice fund that a portion of which could be used to help educate people about what's going on and to try to develop and design interventions, just the way that tobacco taxes are often earmarked to fund cessation programs and to fund public education campaigns. And impact on obesity, if we make the conservative assumption out of all those 76 billion servings, they have an average of 100 calories per serving, which is an underestimate, right? So regular soda is usually 150, but some of the sports drinks are a little bit less. You're looking at 7 trillion calories a year American adults consume from prepackaged sugar-sweetened beverages. So seven trillion, it's almost the national debt. We've got $1 for each calorie. So that's 2 billion pounds a year just to those factors. Now, if there was no sugar-sweetened beverages, that doesn't mean that 7 trillion calories would go away. There would be a redisposition. So I don't want to leave people with that impression, but the weight gain, you know, the 500,000 Ford Explorers and, you know, penny per ounce, given the elasticity of a 10% price increase to an 8 or 10% drop in consumption, you'd be estimating you're talking about, you know, significant, large potential impact. So just to summarize some of the thoughts here, the majority of adults report drinking sugar-sweetened beverages. There's a fair amount of knowledge about the relationship, at least superficial knowledge based on our questions, between sugar-sweetened beverages and health outcomes, but not universal. We're looking at those who consume sugar-sweetened beverages are those with low education, low-income, racial, ethnic minorities. You've got a sizable minority offering, supporting a policy along these lines, but still room to move in that direction. And I'll wrap up with that. I don't know if there's time. Okay. If there's questions, there's time for one or two, perhaps. Yes.
How come you didn't ask per day?
What's?
How come you didn't ask how many sweetened drinks they had per day?
So we had a discussion on this. We didn't really know what we would find. We wanted to capture a broader time scale so that there would be some measurement of recall. But to the extent that people don't recall what has been consumed previously, then we would have an underestimate.
Do you include any of the data that the soft drink industry has? They basically put out numbers of how much the average American consumes as their way to try to monitor where they can get in and increase that. And I've seen values where the average American consumes about 5-12 ounce servings of some sort of pop a day, which would make your numbers
even less. We have started to try to look at industry related, and that's as someone that's done a lot of work in with the tobacco related things and tobacco industry, I take pretty much anything that you know, Coke, Pepsi, with independent research. Actually, a question I had is of those 50 studies, how many of them were funded by non-public health agencies, and if that was in association with what their findings were. But your point's well taken, but I think from the perspective that I would give is that if anything, it's an underestimate than what we have. Yeah. Was it? So if you send me an email, I can get you specifics. Chocolate milk, I think, yes, was asked specifically, and yes, it's a sugar-sweetened beverage. Milkshakes, I'm not sure. I don't recall. And a serving is left up to the, we have interviewer notes to help guide them on what a serving is, but it's largely up to the individual to interpret that on their own. One more.
One comment. I think we need to be very careful. I'm an advocate for increasing the price of sugar-sweetened beverages, and I think tax is a very efficient mechanism to do so. But I think it's also really important that we don't oversell the impact of any one intervention on obesity. That's going to take a comprehensive array of strategies and approaches to do that. So even though focusing on SSB is one very important component of a comprehensive obesity strategy, you don't want to oversell and overpromise. I think we saw that in session around menu labeling, the dangers of overselling and overpromising any single intervention. One particular thing that actually is touted by SSB advocates, of which I'm one, of controlling them, is the pound increase. And so it's probably not true that 3,500 calories will produce a pound of weight increase, because there are homeostatic mechanisms where the body actually plateaus out at a certain amount of weight gain. So it's a little dangerous to kind of say that there's a one-to-one correlation between calories consumed and the total amount of pounds that are going to be gained. And so I just think it's important. We have such a strong case anyway, not to undermine our case by overselling what we know.
Yep, point's very well taken.